We're honoured to have an international guest as the presenter at this month's forum. When she's in Great Britain, Bridget Hutter has a chair in risk regulation at the London School of Economics, but she spent much of this year as a visiting professor at the Australian National University, which is why we're able to welcome her today. Bridget's research interests are in the broad area of regulation and risk management, including the regulation of economic life, organisational risk management, risk anticipation, resilience and natural disasters, and risk regulation in China. She's the author of numerous publications on the subject of risk regulation, including writing the lead story in our most recent member newsletter. Bridget's an academician of the Academy of Social Sciences, a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, an alumnus of the World Economic Forum, of Global Agenda Councils. God, they have some great names, don't they?
Yeah.
In 2010, she was appointed a trustee and board member of the think tank, the Strategy Society Centre. Her focus this evening is on managing risk within governments. Welcome, Bridget. We're all looking forward to your presentation.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting me and coming up here today. Such a nice day. I'm going to focus the talk today on risk regulation and contingency planning. And the reason I think that's so important is that managing risks and preventing disasters has increasingly come into the limelight, and it's become very central to contemporary debates about governance. So the potential for disasters ever present, as we know, and each year, sadly, some of those potentials are realised. And we've got a few examples up here on the slide, of course. There's nuclear safety in the wake of natural disasters, and the Japanese tsunami at Fukushima is one good example of that. Food scares, we regularly have E. coli outbreaks, and natural disasters, which of course you're used to here as well, with bushfires, floods, and in New Zealand, of course, earthquakes. And each of the cases that happens, questions are asked about governments and regulation. Why weren't they better prepared? And it emphasises the expectations that we have that actually it's possible to govern the future. Now, this is a strong theme, actually, in social theory, that we have a very modern preoccupation with risk, and that we live in a world where risk management approaches are increasingly advocated as a way of governing the future and ensuring that we minimise damage from natural disasters. Now, social theorists argue that modern societies are characterised by new risk environments, and they're associated with two things. First, substantive changes in society, and they, in particular, will have a look at the growth of science and technology. It's the growth of science and technology that spurned a lot of the work in social theory. They talk about global risks, which I'm sure we will recognise. They argue these are new risks which confront modern societies. They're risks without national and organisational boundaries. For example, climate change and global warming would be two very prominent examples. Also things like cyber risks, of course. Now, very often these are what we call manufactured risks. They're the unintended consequences of innovations which are seen as very positive and progressive but are found to have negative side effects, which actually the public and the environment can be involuntarily exposed to. And governments typically intervene to regulate and manage those risks, and in doing that they actually exemplify a second feature of modern societies that's been pulled out in social theory in particular, and that is a sort of new way of seeing the world. And the new ways of seeing the world have sort of two parts to them, really. One is that it is argued we have an orientation to the future, whereas in the past we might have looked backwards about what happened in the past. They argue that now we tend to look forwards towards the future. And there's also a belief accompanying that, that we can anticipate, control, and manage risks into the future. And that has crucial consequences for governance, and that's very much what I'm going to be talking about today. It's got crucial consequences for people, practitioners working in the area. So if you take this overall perspective that the social theorists do, regulation is of course one manifestation of that belief that you can anticipate risk and do something about it. And that expectation has become so strong that it's moved from just referring to manufactured risk to actually cover natural risks as well. So there's now an anticipation that we can do something about natural disasters. So, you know, we have hazard plans in place, all sorts of planning about what to do in flood areas. A lot of money being spent on contingency planning around natural hazards. So the notion is that natural hazards are, again, a lot less random than they used to be. Now, the response to all of this may be one of the reasons that you invited me to talk today, and that is that the social and organisational responses to those sorts of ways of, those expectations and ways of thinking about risk have been quite considerable. So we see the creation, I'm sure you have them here as well, of specialist risk management and contingency planning departments. We've seen a growth of those at both governmental level and at business organisation levels, and indeed in the public sector, of course. So governments, for example, in the UK, has the Civil Contingencies Secretariat. The USA probably has one of the biggest and best funded of these, the Department of Homeland Security. And of course, those were themselves established in the wake of 9/11 in particular. The budget that Homeland Security has is quite enormous. It's phenomenally large organisation. And private sector organisations, of course, you have META risk management and compliance departments. You have risk officers, compliance officers, whose jobs are very much tied up with this notion of anticipating risk and putting in place plans to make sure that those risks aren't realised. And in doing that, each of these different sorts of departments will use formal risk management tools. So they've become increasingly popular in this area. And the whole raison d'etre in the area, of course, is to avoid the repetition of previous risk events and to help identify and manage new risks. So they are looking forward to look at what the new risks might be. And the demands on these sorts of departments are quite considerable. I mean, I would argue they might at times be quite unreasonable as well. And I would just point to one of the findings of the 9/11 Commission, which you may have looked at. The 9/11 report is worth reading, actually. It's you can just read it on the web. It's very easy to find it, but it is worth reading. Because they argued that there'd been a lack of institutional imagination on the part of the security services. They said across government there were failures of imagination, policy, capabilities and management, and the most important failure was one of imagination. We don't believe the leaders understood the gravity of the threat, but calling for imagination to play a role there is quite strong, I think, and I think it points to how big those expectations are. It also points to some of the novel methods being used by some of these different departments to try and anticipate risks as well, in terms of pulling in the arts to try and imagine sci-fi sorts of futures and things that might go wrong. And I think that may have been prompted by that sort of comment, which is rather strong. Now, social commentators, social theorists are actually quite sceptical about all of this. They're quite a gloomy lot, as you can see from the slide. Anthony Giddens, who's a former director of the LSE, talked about a plurality of future scenarios and no certainty about which is accurate. His colleague, the late Ulrich Beck, who actually coined the phrase the risk society, talks about the optimistic futility with which highly developed institutions of modern society attempt to anticipate what cannot be anticipated. And Charles Perrow, who's an American disaster theorist, wrote a book called Normal Accidents, and that's premised on the idea that the accidents are indeed normal, that organisations are imperfect and they can't provide complete security. And one of his students, Clark, he talks about organisations trying to control the uncontrollable. So why are they so gloomy? And they are... These are just quotes taken from whole tracts, which will back that up as far as they're concerned. Well, it's partly a recognition, I think, of the very complex social, political, economic and technical decisions that are involved in future-proofing. The first one actually sometimes taken for granted, and that is what constitutes a risk. And that actually is far from clear cut. It's not always agreed what a risk is, and this is probably one of the first things we'll teach the master students coming into the LSE for some of our courses, is that you can't take it for granted that a risk is self-evident. Part of the problem there is that at a technical level, the past isn't necessarily a very good predictor of the future. And the classic example there is the one that I have up on the overhead, which is climate change. We know that climate change is increasing the incidence and the patterns of natural disasters. So it's very hard to use past data to predict what will happen going into the future. So our data sources may actually be problematic, or we might be relying on the wrong data. There are also political perspectives on this as well. Science often becomes very embroiled with politics. And I've got two examples up on the overhead. The first one is ClimateGate. Have you come across this one? Well, ClimateGate involved a politically motivated challenge, it's still not entirely sure where from, about the status of scientific evidence and expert knowledge around climate change. And basically, the controversy happened in November 2009 when a server was breached at the University of East Anglia's Climatic Research Unit. Now, that's one of the main research centres for generating data about global temperatures and precipitation analyses. So 2 weeks before the Copenhagen summit, 160 MB of data was copied from the server and put onto the internet, onto the public internet, so it was publicly available. There was over 1,000 emails, there were 2,000 documents, and they referred to climatic research change from research from 1996 to 2009. So it was basically somebody hacked in, or an organisation hacked in, or a country hacked in, depending on whoever you believe did it, and put this out into the public arena. Now, a lot of what was there was quite technical, quite boring. The controversy focused on a very few emails, and the climate change sceptics, and remember, some very powerful players have been climate change sceptics, alleged that the hacked emails were constituted evidence that climate change scientists were manipulating data. And they claimed the correspondence was evidence of a global warming conspiracy, and that dissenting scientific papers were being suppressed and not allowed into the public arena. Successive inquiries refuted those claims, but it's a really damaging episode because it happens just before the international climate change talks, and it takes many years before these inquiries go through and refute some of the claims that have been made. But it is a good example of how politics and science can become very embroiled with each other. Another example is the volcanic ash episode that happened in Europe in 2010. It's a case that I've used in actually a book that I finished earlier in the year with a colleague on regulatory crises. I mean, basically, this episode closed European airspace down for about 5 days, and then intermittently thereafter. It was caused by a volcano in Iceland erupting, the ash going down over Europe, the weather becoming static, and the advice, the international protocol was that you shouldn't let an aircraft go into volcanic ash, hence the airwaves were shut. But it's an interesting case because in the first few days of the shutdown, the media and policymakers and politicians were talking about how necessary it was to shut the airspace down. But then the airlines began to lose huge sums of money. Massive sums of money. Their planes were stranded, they couldn't move people, it was a peak period of travel, it was Easter. And actually under European law they also had to pay for anyone who was stranded. So it was more than just not having flights up, there's huge amounts of compensation as well. And very quickly two airlines in particular BA and Virgin started to contest the regulations and the science underlying it. We've written about this at length, so I won't go into too much detail now, but they did actually manage to very successfully contest what was happening in public, including the science, motivated, of course, by the loss of money. And it did result within about 3 days in a relaxation in the regulations. The regulators' reaction to what was happening was quite phenomenal, actually. It's a success story in all sorts of ways. It's also another interesting case to the extent that, like many other cases, the two big airlines really were behind this, and a few of the smaller ones, but actually in the course of the research we interviewed quite a few smaller airlines that were really worried that they were going to be given the okay to go back into the air, because they were seriously not convinced it was safe. And of course their margins were even tighter if they lost one plane that was then gone. So you do often find amongst the regulated quite serious divisions about what should be done around regulation. But once you've established what the risks are, and hopefully I've demonstrated that that's not always clear cut, you have to then decide what to do next. So of course future-proofing of the state involves some very difficult choices about social and economic costs and benefits and how they're distributed. Scarce resources have got to be allocated, and decisions will centre on very differing views about the role of the state. Should the state be involved in this at all, or is it a necessary part of their role? When they are involved, are they actually promoting very particular interests to the detriment of others? Differing conceptions of equality and inequality, differing conceptions of freedom and restrictions on trade will underlie some of the decisions that are made about what to do. And relative values are allocated to individual versus collective goods, to future generations, and of course to the environment. So there are some really quite difficult decisions to be made here in terms of economics, but also in terms of ethics and morality as well. And there's typically a great deal of ambivalence about that, because the vested interests involved will be markets, organisations, different stakeholders, consumers, victims, and they may not share common objectives. In fact, they very seldom do share common objectives. Also, the decisions that are taken, as I've said, are as much political and ethical as they are technical and objective. The expectations that we should be able to govern the future, which I was referring to earlier, can of course lead to very strong moral and political imperatives to act to protect the public from risk, but also political imperatives to avoid blame, because if something does go wrong, politicians in particular are very keen that they're not blamed. In fact, some would argue that's why regulators exist, so that government can stay at arm's length from the difficult decisions. It can lead to very strong pressures to act as if governments, organisations and regulators are in control. So they can produce very elaborate plans, very elaborate documents, generate very complicated models. There's a whole set of work about trust in numbers, which is quite sceptical. The reason for the scepticism being that a lot of these plans and contingency plans and models aren't always rooted in strong evidence. So the argument would run that a lot of these documents are generated mainly to give the appearance of being in control and to calm people down. In fact, Clark, whose quote I had on this slide earlier, calls a lot of these documents fantasy documents, and he's written a whole book on them calling them fantasy documents. His biggest example of a fantasy document being plans about what to do in the case of a nuclear war, because he says we don't have any evidence about what to do about that. So actually what he argues what's being created is akin to a fantasy document. But there are dangers involved in all of this, of course. There are dangers that actually, if you aren't rooting your planning in strong evidence, then you can actually generate the wrong policy choices. And Vildavsky wrote a book that I think still warrants reading. I was recommending it when I was in ANU. It's called Searching for Safety. And he argues that it's very important to balance anticipation and resilience. So actually the word resilience, which we know has become like this new kid on the block, it's extremely in vogue. You find it right across the risk regulation contingency planning area now. Vildavsky was writing about this back in the 80s, although the work seemed to get a little bit buried afterwards. But his work's interesting because he says that anticipation in regulation and contingency planning can lead to a lot of very wasted resources. And that's because we may have a very high volume of hypothesised risks. If we all sat and went round the table now and said, what do we think might go wrong, we'd come up with a huge number of different scenarios. And he says that that many of those would be exaggerated, many of them would be false. So we've got to be very careful about focusing on the appropriate strategies in line with the evidence that we have, and that's a really strong message, which I'll talk a bit more about. And I'll talk about it in particular with respect to regulation and disaster mitigation, and when it might be relevant to look at regulation, and that's the work I did with the World Economic Forum, was when was regulation appropriate in areas of natural disaster, and when is it inappropriate? When should we be looking perhaps more towards resilience? So it's about strategy choice. I think one thing that I would point out with respect to the natural disaster area is that expectations of anticipation and control are a little bit softer in this area than they might be in terms of manufactured risks, i.e. human-generated risks. To the extent that we talk about mitigation, we don't talk about zero tolerance. So mitigation has already built within it the notion that we can't stop something happening. So we have to try and minimise the harm. So there is, I think, some implicit, at least, acceptance that there are limits to what we can do compared to techno disasters, but nevertheless, the expectations can still be quite high. And I know when I was in my last weeks in Canberra and when I was in Hobart last week, the discussion about bushfires that I was seeing on the television news were very high on expectations about what could be done and what could be predicted and why things haven't been predicted. So I think we can turn the TV on sort of most days and see examples of this, in fact. Now, there are various forms of mitigation that can prove useful in reducing the damage that can be caused by disasters. You probably know most of these. I mean, risk avoidance strategies can be highly successful. They focus primarily around land use policies, particularly delineating areas where you shouldn't allow settlements, or you should heavily regulate what's allowed to be there. So that's a range from hazard zones where no urban development can happen, through to planning laws in terms of what is permitted. And California, State of California in the USA actually has something called a natural hazard disclosure statement, so you actually can't sell a property without that disclosure statement being provided, and it has to map out what the hazards are, and there are various hazard zones around areas prone to its landslides, tsunamis and wildfire. Japan also has hazard zones, and since 2001 building developments in Japan have been very restricted, although we might not have thought that a few years ago watching our televisions. It was perhaps one of the surprises, because Japan was seen to be one of the more sophisticated countries in terms of its planning, and then we saw, of course, that didn't quite pan out. And the happening in Katrina and Louisiana actually brought forward, as you might imagine, a tsunami indeed of articles coming out of the American academic disaster sort of press. And one of the strong messages coming out of that, led actually by Charles Perrow, the man who wrote about normal accidents, was that they thought that actually what had happened around Katrina had actually been manufactured risk, because in fact the planners had allowed a very big city to grow up in an area of high natural hazard, and had allowed very close proximity of large populations and also quite dangerous industries. So he's written a very, very critical book about how that whole scenario was to some extent actually created by poor regulation and poor planning. So there's quite a strong literature that's grown up in the United States, which is highly critical around these points now, very critical indeed. Another set of strategies that can be used are risk minimization strategies, better known as risk reduction strategies, building codes, especially in earthquake and flooding zones where damage is primarily to buildings and infrastructures, and of course that's how most people tend to be killed, by the buildings falling down. The building controls embrace quite a variety of risk regulation tools, so this is an area where regulation really can work very well in terms of regulations about design, engineering standards, construction standards, and the monitoring of compliance with those. So new building codes are, I think, very commonplace. They can be highly effective, especially if they incorporate learning from previous disasters. The area where it tends to be less effective is in retrospective building and retrofit, because of the cost of that, of course. You always, in these debates, have this balance between the risk and the cost, and that's where a lot of those political decisions, of course, are made, and a lot of the ethical ones too. And the American disaster literature that came about largely after Katrina very much talked about big business having the power to override what would be a sensible planning decision. So there was some very critical work came out of that. But that said, I think there are retrofits. I remember when I went to Wellington being taken around their parliament, and that has a retrofit in it. I don't know how successful it was last time they had an earthquake, actually, but there certainly was taken down and shown what had been put into the building. Mexico City's had a major program of retroactive strengthening as well, and so is California following Northridge. We do know that where building codes aren't enforced or they don't exist, the loss of life might be considerable. And I think one thing I'd say about regulation across the board, it doesn't matter what area you're looking at, if you can have as many regulations as you want, but if they're not enforced, they're useless. So enforcement is absolutely key. And is as important as having the regulation. The other thing that's absolutely crucial, and it's been a bit of a theme of what I've said so far, is information. Governance decisions depend on information being accurate. It depends on the likelihood of a disaster occurring and information about what the probable damage would be should it occur. And the knowledge base upon which any of these policies is formulated is absolutely crucial, and this is really Vildavsky's point in talking about anticipation vis-a-vis resilience. And I think one thing that's a really strong message coming out of a lot of the literature that exists, even some of the high theory stuff as well as the practitioner-oriented literature, is that we need to be really strongly aware of the limitations of the data we've got. We're often sort of boast about the data we have without actually thinking long and hard about what its limitations are. So as I said just now, historic data may be very limited, with climate change being put into the calculations now, because we know it's increasing the incidence of natural disasters and also where they occur. And we know that larger populations are being exposed to the possibility of natural disaster. But we may have a lot less information than we suppose. And I think, again, turning on the television and reading the press sometimes, you'll hear about a disaster that's happened, and you know there'll be an assumption that we know a lot about the particular phenomena that's happened, and we should have been able to do something about it. But actually, it varies enormously according to the sort of disaster that's likely to be involved. So we might have confidence about the location of volcanoes, although we do know we don't know where a lot of volcanoes are, so that's not quite as certain as we might think. We know more or less where flooding might happen, but it's very difficult to locate with any certainty where earthquakes are going to hit, where hurricanes might go, and where wildfires might go. So there's less certainty around those. So there's no certainty about the others, but we know a bit more. And I think the example of Hurricane Gustav is quite a good one. This happened a year after Katrina. And the trajectory and the force of that hurricane proved very difficult to predict. And actually, the policymakers in Louisiana were very worried there was going to be Katrina number two, and they evacuated 2 million people. They took them away from the coast in anticipation of a Category 3 to 4 hurricane, and actually, by the time it had hit the coast, it had actually been downgraded to a Category 2. So that, I think that's a nice example, because it really brings home the difficulties of knowing what to do. You know, what would we all do in that situation? Would you take the risk of what happened the year before happening again or not? And it raises questions about the policy decisions to evacuate. Having evacuated because of Gustav, what would have happened had there been a similar warning the following year? Would people have gone or wouldn't they? How would the policy people have reacted as well to the warnings that came forward? And this is something that came out in the study of the volcanic ash episode in Europe. I remember having a long chat with the head of the Civil Aviation Authority, and she was really worried about what to do. And, you know, I said to her, "Are you worried a plane will come fall out of the sky if you change the limits?" And she said, "I am. I'm really worried, and you're the first person to have sat in my office and asked me that. I've had everybody else been banging the table saying this is all rubbish science." But she's not a scientist, and she needed convincing. Maybe that's a good thing to do sometimes, have somebody who's not an expert there having to be persuaded one way or the other. We do it in the courts every day, so maybe it was a good test here. But those are the sorts of harsh decisions that need taking there. And of course, what we're really talking about here are the risks of risk governance. They're not without their own risks, and they may be considerable. Gustav's an example of a sort of false positive, but there's another very interesting example that you may know about that happened in Italy, in Aquila, around the earthquakes, when actually the experts were asked if they thought there would be a volcano, and was there going to be another earthquake following some tremors, and they said no, and they were wrong. And the earthquake happened, and a lot of people's houses were destroyed, and a lot of people were killed and injured. And in fact, those scientists were put into prison by the authorities, which was a very extreme example, but also a very interesting one, because again, it sharply brings into focus the sorts of decisions and expectations that were there. They were eventually released. There was a massive, I think, worldwide campaign to have them released, but they were actually put criminally convicted and imprisoned for making that wrong call. But of course, these examples also do bring home the notion of wasted resources. And that was one of Vildavsky's key arguments. It's a particularly key argument, I think it's worth saying, when we look at nations that are much more impoverished than our own, when actually money spent on future-proofing might be better spent, or is certainly being taken away from providing better conditions in the here and now. So again, looking at those hard examples can be, I think, quite useful in terms of sharpening up the sorts of decisions that are being made. There can be a lot of unintended consequences around this as well. Risk aversion, fueled by concerns about blame attribution. I mentioned that one earlier. Also, there is a danger that some of the future-proofing that's put into place can make people feel a bit too comfortable. It may stop them, it may offer false reassurance, because if that if that future-proofing fails, then people don't know what to do. They don't have any idea or haven't even thought through what to do. And an example that you will find in the literature there about the levees failing in Louisiana, and people hadn't really even thought about that happening, so they didn't know what to do. Also, the strategies, and again, this is part of Vildavsky's original argument, and I think it's part of the reason that we hear so much about resilience now, is that if we have very careful plans in place, and what happens doesn't fit with those plans, you can reduce the ability of individuals and organisations and societies to cope with what does happen. The whole emphasis of resilience is that it's much more flexible. It's much more downstream-based and downstream-generated. The other thing to think about with risk anticipation also is that you may get value conflicts, and the area I think where you see that the most is around security. If you think about the security we go through at airports, and if you've been through Heathrow, it can take a very... I always turn up to airports around the rest of the world hours before I need to, because I've turned up to Heathrow in the past and had to wait 2 hours to get through screening. So if there's a high alert, it can be really bad. Now, there are huge debates about that, huge debates about whether that security is warranted, whether it's going to make any difference, and whether the trade-off on that one is right or wrong. But I'm not sure who would want to be in the hot seat being the politician who took away that security. So it's again an example of the sort of pressure that you can be put under in order to put security in place. It is interesting that when Heathrow's Terminal 5 was first opened, it was probably more reported in the media because everything appeared to fail in the first week, the baggage didn't come through properly, etc. But actually there was also another backstory going on which did get into the papers, I think, that actually there was a huge fight about the level of security that was going to be put into Terminal 5, and actually what you see now is not what was originally planned, which would have been much more intrusive, much more American style. And there was a huge campaign to stop that happening. So actually that was a very live debate, and it was a very live debate really in the wake of, it must have been 7/7, because Terminal 5 opened, of course, must have been shortly after that. So again, that's another hard case that can show you some of the problems. So the message here really in all of this literature, however grand or otherwise it is to be looking very long and hard at the evidence that's available, critically assessing it, really interrogating how robust it is before formulating policy. So it calls for perspective and caution. It's not saying abandon the project. And I think that's an important message, because some of the quotes that I put up earlier from some of the social theorists in particular looked like they were saying forget doing anything. And I don't think they are saying that. They're saying that what is being done needs to be looked at much more critically. And I think that's why in some countries, but not all, I don't think I come from one that does it, that they very often will incorporate social scientists into these sorts of exercises in order to point the critical finger and ask those critical questions. It doesn't mean you have an answer always, but it does mean you force people to go back and interrogate how good some of that evidence is and what they're doing. Certainly, I think France has a tradition of doing that, and actually Beck, whose work I've quoted here quite a lot, has been incorporated in, when he was alive, he died late last year, into quite a few government commissions in Germany in order to interrogate what was going and ask them some of the harsh questions. But I think something that's really important to remember is that transnationally the effectiveness of these sorts of regimes varies enormously. And I think when you mentioned earlier, Charles, that I've done a bit of work looking at China, it's been limited because I don't have the language facility. But the amount of work I was able to do looking at China was very interesting, because it brought home some of the things we might take for granted in our own work. And that's a sort of prerequisites of having a stable government. The prerequisites of having a legal system that has, you know, some legitimacy and having good governance systems in place. I mentioned that enforcement is absolutely key if you're going to have regulation. If you look at China, if you look at Turkey and their earthquakes, they've lost very large numbers of people, including in China, and one of their recent earthquakes, a large number of children, who of course were single children, because they had the one-child policy, created because of bribery and corruption of officials and not enforcing proper codes. So it really does sharpen up how important that enforcement is. We might not have that level of corruption, but mild forms of capture might be equally dangerous. The other thing that comes out of a lot of this work, and again, it's where the resilience literature is, I think, is that central-local relations are key to securing good governance as well. There's no point in having the centre imposing regimes. They have to be secured and agreed at a local level. And very often the resilience literature will argue with local communities and populations. In Hobart, actually, when I was at the University of Tasmania, they're starting some work looking at bushfires with local communities to see how they're interpreting it and what they know and what the community level perspectives are. And something else that comes out of the literature is the importance of what's called tacit knowledge, that actually there may be very local, specialised knowledge that can be put to good use. And there are two examples of that. I don't know, I've heard conflicting debates about the first one, and it came out of the Wellington conference that I spoke at, and it was around the Christchurch earthquakes. And now a number of people at that conference claimed that had the Maori population been spoken to, they would have known where the dangerous earthquake areas were. They were areas that they would never have lived in. Others have disputed that that was the case. That's the politicisation of knowledge again. But there is something that is rather more, I know, to be more robust than that. That's simply reactions I got at a conference, but it's an interesting example. And that was the case of Chernobyl. And as you probably know, the Chernobyl fallout affected farming in the north of England, in particular sheep farmers in the Lake District. And there was a big debate about rules being imposed out of London onto the Lake District about how safe the levels of radiation were up there. And actually nobody spoke to the farmers, who actually knew how their sheep were behaving and that actually knew they weren't behaving properly, that something was wrong. And there was quite a lot of critical work done around that afterwards, which said sometimes it's important as policymakers to not just engage, but to listen, because there may be really important local information that may look quite minor to you, that actually may actually be incredibly helpful. So the message there really is that increasingly proofing the state is a multi-party activity, and increasingly it's becoming that in terms of embracing policymakers, local authorities, and local populations, but also it's increasingly pulling in insurance industries. And in fact, when I teach courses at the LSE on risk governance, I've got a session on insurance, because some people have claimed that insurance is replacing government in terms of the governance of risks. I think there's a question mark over that personally, but the arguments are there. And certainly in terms of natural risks, risk sharing fiscal arrangements involving insurance companies are quite popular and are much discussed. And there are a number of ways, of course, in which governments can work with insurance companies to make insurance work to some extent. They can link it to risk regulation strategies, which happens all the time, actually. Insurance does try and shape behaviour by lowering premiums for certain sorts of behaviour, not smoking, for example, having burglar alarms. It can do it around things to do with natural disasters as well. It can persuade communities, individuals, families to invest in mitigation measures. Governments also enter partnerships with insurers, sometimes mandating that insurance has to be, insurance companies, A, if they operate in their area, have to provide insurance for natural disasters, and B, saying that individual householders have to have insurance. So there are ways in which those arrangements have been tried out around the world, and I think in New Zealand there are government-backed insurance schemes for earthquake damage, and the cover's compulsory. So using risk regulation and other measures to mitigate natural and other disasters can, we know, contribute significantly to reducing the risks and costs of disasters. A UN report produced in 2009 on disaster risk reduction, the UN does quite a lot of work in this area, takes the example of Japan and the Philippines, both countries exposed to frequent cyclones, but the estimated annual death toll from cyclones in the Philippines is about 17 times higher than that of Japan, where there's considerably more investment in prediction and planning than in the Philippines. The benefits of good governance and planning can be considerable, but as I think I've emphasised very strongly now, it needs to be used very strategically. The quality and accuracy of data is the one thing I would strongly pull out in this area, but actually in using risk models in any other sort of area. We have risk-based regulation mandated in the UK for regulators, and the quality of the information they use is absolutely at the core of that as well. So there is a real read across, I think, in terms of this. But the message is that where the levels of certainty are high and we have good, high-quality information, then detailed risk regulation measures and planning are possible. Where they are not available, then you might be wasting huge amounts of resources and giving false assurance. So at a much bigger level, I think we need to understand that we can put far too much faith in our abilities to govern the future. So the sorts of scenarios that are being talked about, the sorts of scenarios where we turn on the television, something's gone wrong, and we say, who's to blame for that, actually can have some quite damaging effects in terms of making people at least put something in place that appears that they knew what they were doing or know what they're doing when they might be wrong. The state does come through as actually important in a lot of these scenarios. It's not got a wasted space anymore. It is important, but I think what's increasingly clear, I'm doing some work on the environment now and it's very clear there, is that it's quite important to empower a whole range of other participants. And the move from government to governance is, of course, embracing that, really. It's just sort of hammering home, I think, that it needs to be done much more effectively. Often there's lip service to that. And the future-proofing of the state needs to be very cooperative. I think that, again, is a major message that comes through, with an emphasis on good governance. So I will finish there. Thank you for your attention.